Kelman on CliffCentral.com.
It is the Gentleman's Roundtable on Kelman on Cliff Central. Let's say what's happening to Mr. Vaughn Field. What's happening, dude?
I'm just trying to live my life.
Okay, yeah.
I'm good, brother.
You're wearing formal shoes today. You're a real person.
Yeah, today I'm a real person.
I get nervous when I see people like adulting and being real people.
Hey, bro. You know? Hey, bro. When I adult, I put on my big boy shoes.
Now, the problem is if you start wearing them like 2-3 days in a row.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Then all of a sudden you have life insurance.
Yes, indeed. And they call you, bro. It's like they know, bro.
Then you die. Do you have a life insurance, Prince of Theatre at Rakhani?
I do. I started adulting at a very, very young age. I mean, I don't know who told him I could do this. I'm not sure who said that it was something that Atando Gani could do. But yeah, I'm adulting.
You're a proper real person.
I am. Yeah. I am. I'm a full grown three dimensional human being.
How does that feel?
I'm not sure because sometimes I fail at it. So it's touch and go. It's, you know, it's trial and error.
Yeah, it is. It's a funny thing growing up and adulting.
It's a horrible thing.
It's a very difficult thing.
Listen, just before we get into this, dude, you're working on so many things at the moment. Let's get that out the way real quick. How many things are going on? What's going on? All I see is press releases from people about you.
You know, you got to keep on the grind, man. You know, you got to keep on doing what you love doing. I often say to myself, as an actor, as an artisan, as a performer, when I'm not acting, what am I? I mean, I understand that I'm a qualified actor and whatnot, but I'm a human being too. And I was always a human being before I became an actor. So if I'm not acting, then I'm not an actor anymore? Does that make sense? Anyway, so I'm working on Sizwe Banzi is Dead, which is a theatre show directed by Dr. John Gani alongside Nedisi Shabangu, which we've taken from Joburg to New York, Cape Town, PA. We've just come back from Bloemfontein, and at the end of this month, we're taking it to the Kaka and Ka Arts Festival.
Very cool.
And then we're waiting for, I'm still waiting for the dates for the release of the short story shot into a film directed by Jared Kutsia called The Suit. Where I play Philemon and Putin again plays Matilda. So that's coming. That's the film that we've just recently shot. Now, what we're shooting currently, that's coming out on the 14th of this month, is Ashes to Ashes.
Ah.
That Atando has just recently joined.
Very cool. We have Zenande Mfanyana as a regular on the show.
Really?
She's been so busy with this Ashes to Ashes recently that we haven't seen her for a while. But she is, she can't speak highly enough about that production. And going into it, they didn't realize it was going to be as big as what it was. And everyone's very excited for the second season now. So that's cool.
It's great, man. Second season is going to be, I keep on looking around set and seeing all these actors and the new actors that they've introduced. And I kept thinking, this is going to be amazing. I mean, you've got Atando Gani, then there's Menzi Ngubane, then there's Tina Chakla. I'm like, and then you're adding them onto this whole cast. And it's just, and Clive Morris' production is just so professional and so accommodating and so amazingly brilliant.
Yeah, it's a big show that, because, I mean, I don't know how many sets there even are. Everything's on location. Doesn't that make it longer to do?
It does. But when you have very experienced performers, everything seems to move sort of, you know, seamlessly and quickly.
All right, so let's get into some of the stuff on the GRT today. We're going to kick it off with this because I binged House of Cards over the weekend, the fourth season, which it just dropped on Netflix. But watching a U.S. political thriller, one can't help but then think of Donald Trump. And this is interesting. Researchers have discovered that there's a clear connection between Donald Trump's political success and the fears of white America. A group of researchers, it turns out, has been quietly watching a trend towards Trump's kind of appeal to play on emotions. And they found that there is a clear connection between white fear and supporting Donald Trump. And he's strategically using this in his campaign.
White fear, meaning white people are afraid of anybody else but Donald Trump.
No. So Donald Trump is saying things that white people who are afraid, I mean, how do I put this in?
White people that are afraid of things people. That don't exist.
Afraid of black people, afraid of any other sort of
religion or race, whatever.
Staunch white people are, he's saying things that are appealing to them.
Of course, yeah.
And you can see it in what he says about the Mexicans, what he says about the Muslims. He's basically saying, dear white person, if you don't want to get blown up by a Muslim terrorist, make sure that you vote for me. I mean, that whole political game in the States, let's just zoom out for a second. And what do we think about how they conduct their politicking in America with the Democrats, the Republicans, the way that they roll it out, the fact that there's these live debates, the fact that, you know, the different states have different levels of influence in terms of who the leadership is going to be. Mm-hmm. What do we think of their system before we even touch him?
I don't know. From my side, I like the fact that it's condensed. I think in South Africa we've got so many different parties, and it's almost a bit ridiculous having 20 or 25 parties. I don't know what the exact number is. So I think having it, you know, Republicans and Democrats, and then having the various people representing those two parties is a good thing, because it's a little bit condensed. The people, you know, the majority of the votes either go one way or the other. And in South Africa, it's a little bit diluted, so we don't really get a true reflection of what a majority would be, you know, in that sense. So I like that. I do also like the fact that they have these open debates and they do, you know, go at each other, even within the party. So you'll see Republicans competing for that number one spot, and they usually, you know, that those arguments and those debates are usually very interesting to see. And I also think it's important for the people to see the ability of a leader in a situation like that. How does he conduct himself in a debate? How does he articulate his points? How, you know, what's his train of thought? How does he think? How does he plan on implementing policy, et cetera, et cetera? As opposed to just reading policy on paper, going to a couple of rallies, getting all pumped up, and then putting your vote down, as we do in South Africa. I think it's quite nice to see the intellectual ability of the leaders who you're going to vote for at that level. So I enjoy that. I enjoy that part of their process.
I mean, I agree completely on that. I was thinking now that, I mean, the leaders that we have here and the politicians, whenever they have an open forum or whatever, it's something that's been written and they're just going to read it out and they don't really take questions, or the State of the Nation address or whatever. But so imagine if you had these public figures, these political figures, as you said, just like on a stage, and they go at it. There's only so much that you can sort of hang on to from what's been written before.
Yeah.
And now you have to sort of engage intellectually and try to solve this problem that you're debating or you entered into the discourse about. And it, like you're saying, it shows the true sort of mental capacity of the leader that you're going to sort of appoint.
Yeah.
It shows the charisma, it shows the courage. And it just, I would love to watch even our politicians in this country, if that would happen. What would happen?
It'd be awesome.
I think it'll be trending on Twitter, but I'm not sure for the right reasons. Though.
We see a bit of an insight into what that could be with, like, the State of the Nation address. You kind of see glimpses of what it might be to have a little bit more of a fiery kind of parliament in that.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, though, that when I see, you know, Donald Trump using white fear in his campaign and everything, it just, again, makes me so despondent in what politics is, and just reminds me that globally, no matter where you are, politics very rarely does benefit the end user, does benefit the citizens, because it's such a strategic game, you know.
It is.
People are gearing up now for municipal elections in South Africa, for the national election, and how much of it is actually, and when I was watching the State of the Nation address as well, just across the board, I was like, but how much of this is going to benefit the end user, the person that's put these people in these seats in the first place?
Yeah.
It's a weird thing. I mean, even, so we in this production that we're doing, which is closely related to what we're talking about, Caesar Banzi is dead, we're talking about the passbook system that they introduced and how it was filled with 192 pages and you could never get it all right and in order. So there was something always wrong, and how they're talking about issues, service deliveries, you know, about education, about poverty, about going into a new transition. And then you have this post-democratic era and you only seem to hear the voice of the politicians when there's some sort of election that's approaching. And look at it now, municipal elections in 2016. What did we hear and the promises that we heard of anything in 2015 and 2014? They weren't really sort of surfacing. And you look at it now, now they're starting to come up. Now they care. Now they're starting to make all these promises.
Yeah.
But then what happens afterwards, as it has been happening for so many years, since 2096 and whatnot, there's no result. There's no end result. The people that were impoverished prior to this transition into this post-democratic government are still there. So what happens? So we're gonna go vote and then nothing happens?
Yeah.
That's mainly it. I mean, it really gets me gets me fired up, man.
Yeah. I also get really passionate about that, because I think of it in a way that, if you know, 22 years ago you voted a party in that changed that at that point changed the course of South Africa, changed many people's lives. You know, basic human rights were afforded, etc. But you look at it back, you look back now, and you think specifically over the last 10 to 12 years, Not much has changed for that specific, for that group of people that were suffering back then. Not enough has happened. So for me, when I think of it, I cannot imagine the frustration and the pain that is brought by something like that, and how despondent you would get about even taking part in these things, which is sad for South Africa, because we should be excited about voting. We should be excited about a democracy. But it's like the way it's been handled and the way things are going or have gone, it just puts like a bad taste in your mouth because you almost feel like the democracy part of it is a lie.
I mean, we're not saying that there's not been any progress, you know. Otherwise, you wouldn't be sitting
here.
No,
for sure. Yeah.
There's pass rates that have gone up. There are the housing rates that have gone up.
Definitely.
But I mean, that in comparison to what they sought out to do is what I'm saying. Yes. That in comparison to the people that vote for the people on the ground that have been promised a better life, you know, been promised education, that have been promised service deliveries like running water and electricity.
Land, all these things.
What's happened to them? You know, we've just implemented this midsection of an economy that's just BEE, and then we've just separated from the poor from the rich even more.
Yeah.
You know, and I understand black economic empowerment. I understand, but was it implemented correctly?
Yeah,
definitely.
The one thing though that it does do, disillusionment with politicians, is fuel unbelievable art across all spheres, because suddenly artists have something to have an opinion about. And create content around.
Yeah.
And the other thing it does is that it gets people to, in their own capacities, do more and not rely on politicians. I mean, you're an artist, Atandwe.
Yes.
If you had to sit down right now and decide to write a play, my God, are there enough things for you to
absolutely
write a play about?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And also, I would imagine that part of your work is trying to reflect a lot of what's happening in society to society itself.
Well, the reason why we started, I keep on going back to Cesar Bundy, the reason why we did this play.
Oh, iconic, yeah.
Yeah, what we did this play is because of the similarities between 1972 and now. The economic similarities, the
social
people,
tensions.
Absolutely. Yeah. People, nothing's changed. Nothing's evolved that much.
Yeah.
Because it's from 72, and I understand that we are also a country that sold this romanticized notion of a
rainbow nation
and how much we've made progress into the world things. South Africa's so great. I mean, have you seen them? Like, nobody, like, they all love each other. But, like, honestly, you can't do that when you're in your situation in the States. It's been how many years
since
slavery? But you're still now, there's still people getting killed in New York on the street.
Exactly.
I can't breathe, for instance. You know what I'm saying? In Ferguson. So, also, to make... Also, artists are number one enemy to the state. Because we are the ones who expose. We're the ones who are bold enough to stand up. If you're a poet, if you're an actor, if you're a painter, you're always targeting the corrupt system. And unfortunately, some of the art that we make needs to be funded by the government. So the way they censor you is not to fund you.
Mm.
So it's very difficult. So you got to play it very carefully.
It's a fine line, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, we very often on the show ask, what is the state of the Rainbow Nation? Is that idea of a Rainbow Nation actually invalid? And some people are very staunch about the fact that that doesn't exist. There is no such thing as a Rainbow Nation, and that people are kind of just fooling themselves.
I think we are a Rainbow Nation in the sense that we've got so many diverse cultures and races. But, you know, the notion of it, of everyone sort of accepting each other is false. I think that still needs to be worked on. And it goes back to what you were saying, like that notion of a rainbow nation, everyone being sold, everyone loves each other. It is a perfect picture to paint. But the reality is that, you know, 20 years ago, we were segregated and racism and being racist was allowed by law. So it was law and it was the way it was. You were brought up in that world and it was law for you to do that. It was legal. Today, it might not be the law, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's been addressed in our social settings, right? So I think like South Africa needs a leader and young leaders and many leaders to address those problems in society. Not just because it's not law anymore doesn't mean it doesn't exist, and it's more than likely going to exist a lot more because 20 years is such a short time in comparison to other democracies and how far along they are with their with their progress. So I think like those type of things need to be addressed, and that's what's important about art and about people like yourself that take these problems and bring them to light or put them into a play or into a poem or whatever it may be. The more people do that, you know, the more the dialogue opens for us to talk about these things in our social settings. And those are the things that need to be addressed by our leaders today. Not necessarily, like, obviously policy, etc., needs to be implemented, but a lot of the problem comes from the lack of understanding socially of what progress really means.
Yes. I mean, were we not a rainbow nation before? I'm thinking to myself now, what were we before?
Exactly.
Did we not have as many cultures and races before? We did. Now, are we going to say, is it a solidified? Is there a reconciled rainbow nation now? I think there needs to be a change in the title. Because as Africans, what we're named means a lot. So the association with certain things from the name is what we take personally. So that's what I'm trying to think. And reconciliation, there's been this debate to reconcile. It means that there was some sort of conciliation prior so that you come back to it to reconcile. So what does that mean for our, were we ever conciled?
Well, this is the thing. We've had a lot of people on the show that have said that the reconciliation process post-1994 was not sufficient, which is why it takes like a Penny Sparrow in January to drop a Facebook comment and it ignites a conversation. It's like it's almost like the pus underneath the pimple and then it pops and then all of a sudden the stuff comes to the surface. And then we're sitting in March now and everyone's kind of moved on from that.
It's gone, it's finished.
But it'll take someone else doing a tweet or a Facebook post or whatever and it'll reignite it again. So my thing is like, and this is why we try and keep the conversation going throughout the year.
Yeah.
Because what happens is that people continue to think the way that they're thinking and stay connecting with people that have similar opinions to them. And then it takes one person to say something and then everyone remembers that. And all the emotions come to the surface again. And then, you know, the nature of human beings that we then forget and move on. But we haven't really addressed the core issue, which is what people are saying about that reconciliation process, is that the core issue wasn't properly addressed. So how do you move forward, really move forward, not just move forward because it's easier and the lazy thing to do as a human being?
But we never fix issues, is what I think in this country. We always sort of, we always talk about them and then promise to fix them and then we sort of move on from them. So we always, it's always bubbling under this anger. And we are a nation of defensive people. We're always just waiting for someone to say something wrong and we can jump on it. And the thing is, socially now, you have to be the first one to jump on it. So,
but how do we change that? I mean, your job is about connecting with people and getting people to think about things in an entertaining way and disguising stuff that's educational as entertaining. So how does one do that, even in just a personal context? Because you can't change the whole country. You can change the people around you, and then they change other people. So it's a pay it forward thing.
Yeah, I think it's education. Not necessarily like school.
But you've got to get people out of the groups that they're in, because people are in groups that and they just reiterate each other's opinions.
Yes.
No one's exposing themselves to other opinions. They're just continuing in the same vein.
But now that's almost like where I was going at. So, for instance, what I'll try to do, maybe it'll be better for me to explain it like this. So what I'll try to do is if I ever get into a situation where I feel like a conversation like this will come up and I'll have a strong viewpoint on what I believe should happen going forward in South Africa and not really focusing on what happened, but what can we do to get better. And I'll say something and maybe another white person will say to me, but that's not right, or that's not how it should happen, or that's reverse racism, or that's whatever they may think. I will then try to take the time to explain myself from where I'm coming from. So educate them on why I think this is what should happen and try and show them that it's not something that's going to, that should harm you or that should hamper your future, you know, or whatever the case may be. Because a lot of the time people get defensive and people get on their high horses because they think you're attacking them. And a lot of the time our politicians come across like they're attacking.
Even, I don't think people are even listening, because sometimes I'll watch people speaking to each other and I can see the other person formulating their response without listening to what the other person is
saying. A lot of the time. And it's because they come from that place of, you're attacking me. So they've already got something lined up. But
That's hard to change.
It is. And the only way I try to do it is if it's a conversation and I try to get the reason behind why I say this across. That's all I can really do.
I think there needs to be like an exodus, man, like a mass movement for like a conscientization of self, the individual. And I say this because another show that we created called Hayani about the journey of the individual. Back in apartheid, we had the mass congregations against one common enemy. You know, hundreds and thousands of people sort of came together and they boycotted and they threw stones and whatnot. Now you have this post apartheid, this now democratic era. Who is the individual within that mass? Who is an individual within the congregation, within the community?
Yes.
So once we find that out, then we start doing self-respect. Then we understand you get the worth of self within the community, which means that to respect another person, you have to respect yourself first.
Yeah.
And give the other person enough time when you're in a conversation to talk. Yes. I'm not listening to respond, I'm listening to understand.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. Like you alluded to something that's very important. The fact that previously there was a clear goal for what had to happen.
Yes.
There was a clear common goal. Today, there's not so many clear common goals. because everyone is so segmented, so divided in opinion and whatever the case is. And that, sorry. And that's why I think the youth needs to come together a little bit more and create new common goals, or create a new common goal that will create a new way of living. Because right now, I think Socrates says it. Socrates said something along the lines of, the key to changing, it's going to be in the spoken household, the key to changing, the key to creating change is not on fighting the old, but on focusing on creating the new. So those, that type of philosophy, I think we need to adapt and say, okay, cool, what can we create that's new, that will fix the problems that we're facing right now? You know, as opposed to not the problems we faced back then. We are facing problems right now. What can we create that's new that will address them?
So this self-worth point is a very interesting point. And if we pivot the conversation and take it to sort of a different lane, but in the same lane with that in mind, for three guys sitting around a table, and we're looking at this topic of self-worth, I mean, what does that even imply to you, this idea of self-worth? Because everyone in the world is actually struggling with this. And self-esteem, and am I anything, and I value my own self-worth in terms of how many Instagram likes I get, but I can't put the picture up without spending 10 minutes on editing it because I have to put the filter because I don't think that my skin looks good like that, and I think that I look overweight like that, or let me take 100 pictures before I put something up. So self-worth, and this is it's a big deal for a dude to even approach this, so... To you, good luck. But your relationship with your self-worth, Atanda?
My relationship, I call myself the Prince of
Peace. You're very confident. I think you're a confident guy, though. I don't know. But maybe you come across as confident, but you're actually really sensitive.
Well, look, we're all human beings at the end of the day. We all carry emotion and emotional archives and things that have happened to us that has made our life journey slightly more difficult and obstacles. So we're all affected, essentially. But I'm not going to wait for the next person to tell me what I am. I'm rather going to tell myself that and not impose it and perhaps hope that you just catch along. You know what I'm saying? I feel that there's no use in sitting back in a slump and saying to yourself that you are worthless.
Yeah.
There is no use. Because try it. I swear to you, you'll come back to me later and say, no, I'm not doing that anymore. So why not try the opposite? Try telling yourself that you are great. You know, speak it into existence. I am in existence. I am great. I am going to be powerful. I'm going to be influential. I'm a great human being. I'm a great son. I'm a great father. I'm a great brother. You know, speak that. And you start doing that. Because now you've told yourself that you are. You can't let yourself down. You've already been there, remember? So you got to move forward now.
Yeah.
When did you start doing that with Prince of Theatre? Because that's everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, in every bar of yours, every Twitter, whatever it is, you put that out there. What was that change? When did you start doing that initially, and what have you tapped into by doing that? Because you're very open about that.
Yes. It was in my second year in varsity at Wits in 2005, and it was a simple conversation, actually, but I think it was leading somewhere, and we were like, do you know, like, John Travolta is called, like, you know, the King of Cool, and then Samuel L. Jackson is, like, the Prince of Suave. What would you call yourself in relation to your job and what you want to do, what you aspire to do? And I think I was the only one who came up with Prince of Theatre because it just rolled off the tongue nicely. It has nothing to do with what I had accomplished. Nothing. It was my second year. But it's like Prince of Theatre.
Like a really good Twitter bio.
I know, right? So I went on with it and I changed my Facebook and I changed my Twitter and whatnot. And people started feeling like, but why are you the Prince of Theatre? I'm like, but why are you not calling yourself something?
Yeah.
But why? I'm not, and right now I'm like, I'm only the Prince of Theatre because no one's had the guts to say I'm not.
Yeah.
And what it's tapped into is that I started finding myself getting more attention in terms of the work, in terms of my now, when I've called myself the Prince of Theatre, people are coming to the theatre saying, oh, let's see this Prince of Theatre guy, okay, let's see what's going on.
Yeah.
Which means now it raises my bar.
Yeah.
I've done myself. I put myself in this hot water. Now I've got to, you know, sit it out.
Yeah.
And it's made me intensify my work. It's made me sort of want me to call myself the king now. I call myself the Jesus of theatre or something. You know what I'm saying? Because people are expecting a lot, but I should expect more from me.
Kanye does this on a grand scale.
I was just about to say, that's exactly what he does. He puts himself in that position and he kind of says, I don't need you to put me there. I'll put myself there and then I'll show you why I do that. That's like
I said, he said in an interview, why do you worry about what I call myself? Like, would you rather I call myself the N-word or would you rather I call myself a slave?
Why does it bother you?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the other thing on self-worth, though, I just think of this when you asked, how do you measure your self-worth? So I think one thing I do, and one thing I've learned to do is that I feel I'm an individual, all right? So everything I do and the way I appear and the things I say, and it usually comes from obviously I'm affected, as you mentioned, but a lot of it comes through myself doing introspection and thinking and trying to act as an individual outside of a society, and how do I feel, how do I think, what do I want to do, what makes me happy, and these type of things, right? So I see myself as that. But one thing that I think helps me understand self-worth is that because I think of myself like that, I go out and I treat everybody I meet like that. Because I feel like if I want to be seen as an individual, the first place to start is by treating other people as individuals. So if I meet somebody, I'll talk to them, I won't have any blueprint for how I should approach them because they're black or they're white or they're Asian or they're Muslim. I will try and not have any kind of reference to how I should talk to this person or approach them. I'll rather come up to them as a person and try and understand and see who they are. I think in that way, it teaches me how to also be an individual by approaching other people as individuals too.
But you also teach people how to treat you. So you mustn't forget that. I mean, even if it's people think I'm conceited and I'm so arrogant and whatnot and blah, 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 blah. What other people think of you is none of your business, first and foremost. So you teach people how to treat you. I remember this one time where my mother had said something to me, but I misconstrued it completely. And it hurt me profusely because I was like, how could you say that? And then she fixed it, but then she apologized. I'm like, my mother apologizing. And it made me feel, oh, snap. I mean, then I can do the same. Then I can do the same because, I mean, I've given her years of hell. And with no apology. So now we have a relationship.
That's what you mean, yeah.
I'm sorry, I did this, it was a mistake and whatnot. So if you continue with that, my mother taught me how to apologize to her, and I apologize whenever I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Or whenever I feel that, you know.
Because that generalization is like a sin. Like generalizing people based on something is a sin. Like I never want to be part of a generalization, and I never want to generalize anybody else.
Yes.
So because I don't want to be a part of a generalization, I won't go and generalize others in a sort of with a negative context or whatever it may be. So I try to do that so I can be seen as an individual myself.
How does one be really objective with oneself though? This is what I don't understand. Like how do you, when you look at yourself in the mirror, be objective and not be influenced by emotions or what you think that you want the outcome to be? How do you maintain objectivity with yourself? Because I think that's really hard.
You're the only person that's going to be honest to yourself. Like I'm
but it's hard. I think it's hard to really be that. I mean, you've been through 4 years of like wits where they tear you apart in drama class, bro. But not everyone's had that experience of lying on the floor and contemplating life and all of that. But so, which is why I'm trying to tap into, you know, how you do it. And Vaughn, you also are a shining example of this. But a lot of people, it's difficult to be honest with yourself. I'm overweight. I should stop eating that. I am not nice to other people. I play with other people's emotions too easily. I allow people to treat me in a bad way. It's difficult to say these things about oneself.
But what are you projecting to people? What is the image that you're projecting? What is the mental state that you're projecting to other people? And that, if you feel that you can't achieve what you want, you start regressing in your own self. The thing of going to gym. I mean, I don't have the most perfect body. I've said I wanted to go to gym for the longest of time. That's what I've been wanting to do. But every time I look in the mirror, I'm like, but you haven't been, you know? And recently, but I'm like, but if you want to portray a certain image physically, if you want to have a certain physical attribute about yourself, you're going to need to make that first step. That's what you need to do. Otherwise, it's not going to happen at all. You're not going to swallow a pill and tomorrow you've got a six-pack.
You have to be honest with yourself about that, yeah.
I was about to say that. I think, I don't know, that's a very difficult question to answer as well. As much as it is a difficult thing, it's difficult to say this is what you can do to be more honest with yourself, right? Because I think that changes for everybody because everyone is individual. But I do think practice is the main thing. I think the more you the more introspection you try to. So if you're feeling depressed, okay, or you're feeling bad about your life or about something or about someone, whatever it may be, I did this because I kind of had to. I didn't have anybody that would lift me up besides, let's say, my mother, you know. But even that relationship growing up is a complicated relationship throughout, you know, it's ups and downs. So in my later years when I sort of lived on my own and stuff and I would feel some type of way, I would rely on myself to try to figure out what the solution is. And I'd make a lot of mistakes with my honesty. Sometimes your honesty with yourself could be based on stupid things. Like you could be irrational. Maybe your honesty was irrational. Maybe you didn't. And you know, when you try and you practice, you start learning about what it is and what it takes to be objective and to have the ability to take yourself outside of yourself and look at the situation, right? So for instance, if you're feeling depressed, maybe you start and say, what makes me feel depressed? Maybe you say, okay, it's because of the way people like talk to me at varsity. I don't feel a part of anything. I don't feel included, so I feel alone. Then you start saying, but why do they do that? Why are they just bad people? Is everyone just a bad person? That would be irrational to think that. So why would it be? Then you try to break it down and say, maybe it is because I don't believe in myself enough, therefore nobody wants to engage with me because maybe I give off an aura of depression. And why do I give that off? Is it because I'm overweight? Maybe, actually, you know what? I think if I wasn't overweight, I'd feel a bit more comfortable and da da da. And it's like sort of a chain reaction, right? So that's how I started doing it. And then I would try to find the core problem and then try and solve it on my own and be like, no, but then I have to change that. Otherwise, if I don't change it, I must accept this for the rest of my life. And that realization
made
me...
That's the switch. Some people actually just do accept it, and then some people want to change it. So exactly. you've got to be inspired to change it within your own capacity.
Exactly. Otherwise, it's never going to happen, bro. You're not going to change anything if you're not inspired to do it yourself.
I don't want to run out of time. By the way, this is the first conversation in history that started out with Donald Trump and then turned into something positive.
I know.
So that's great. Look at us setting records.
It's under the energy, bro.
I'm gonna say let's wrap it up, but I'm not gonna say anything. I want the two of you to kind of wrap it up and give the final take. Because I actually don't know what we've spoken about.
We've been so astute and so revolutionary, but like about what?
So I don't even know.
The self.
So I'm going to give that problem to you guys and you can wrap it up. You've got about 3-4 minutes and go.
Okay. I want to wrap it up by kind of summarizing what we spoke about. So it is the first conversation that started off with Donald Trump and ended up in something positive. But I think that's something that we should all, specifically in today's... time, we should maybe adapt that philosophy in our lives and look at the situation worldwide and the crises and the problems that everybody's facing in the States. And I mean, morons like Trump having a chance at winning elections, and South Africa's own problems and Syrian refugees and the problems all over the world. Maybe we look at these situations and we try and find a way to swing it in for the positive. Maybe this is a time for the world to come together for solutions. Maybe it's a time to look at all the sort of the dire state of most economies worldwide, and let's try and find the light. And if we can't find the light, let's collectively try and be the light.
Ooh, lovely. I want to try and wrap it up by starting at where we the initial point of Donald Trump and his white fear, which I think is the age-old American diversion tactic. When something else is happening, then you focus on something else. You create another fear. 9/11 was that fear that they created because something else was happening, yeah, and pending and bubbling. So that diversion tactic, the black people are bad. The black people are going to get you. The black people. So you're like, oh my gosh, I must vote for Trump, because if I vote for Trump, then black people disappear. And in that diversion tactic, you know, you're lying to people, and we transgressed and we moved on to the self. And stop, don't lie to yourself, but be honest with yourself. Don't be harsh on yourself, but be honest with yourself. Be honest with yourself in terms of engaging with other people, in terms of how you want to be seen, what you want to portray. You don't have to have the perfect figure or the perfect anything, you know. You don't have to be the most beautiful person, but you just, how you affect another person is what's going to carry on for the rest of your life in terms of the impression. And what we need to do is just start, as I say, start teaching people how to treat you. So you have that self-worth and that self-confidence. So everybody's going to want to be, you know, very humane in a way, so that they can get that back.
Power, that there is the gentleman's round table. Happens every Monday just after. Producer Cat's clapping. Why are you clapping, Producer Cat? Did we, what struck you the most there?
That was probably one of the best GRTs we ever had. It was very deep.
Yeah, there you go. All right, that there's the GRT. Atanwa Khani, thank you so much. Our special guest on today's Gentleman's Roundtable. Vaughn, always a pleasure.
Sweet, bro.
Yeah, man. Gentlemen on CliffCentral.com.